dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the men that we are proud to feature here prominently and are even more proud of his many contributions in a lot of other places is our first guest. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He's one of our regulars, but he brings to bear in this program and elsewhere an extraordinary career of service to our country and more generally of work on behalf of freedom. And he's a former Army officer, a former CIA undercover operative, former candidate for Congress, an author, an essayist, and the driving force now of behind a terrific online resource and magazine.com. I commend it to you in the strongest of terms. Sam, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back, and thank you again for all you do for the cause in the country, including not least your contribution to a very important webinar that our Committee on the Present Danger China, of which you are a member, did yesterday. And I really commend it to our audience, as I hope you will to yours. Presentdangerchina.org is where you can find the video with Sam and many of our other featured guests here on Secure Freedom Radio. But welcome back, my friend. It's good to have you with us.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, Sam, and much of it's not very good. You have been very actively engaged in trying to help us understand what's at stake and what now likely been put in train in terms of repercussions of, well, what I think of as Biden's defeat in Afghanistan. Give us your sense of his remarks yesterday and kind of where we find ourselves at the moment with respect to that theater most immediately, but its knock-on effects as well.
Well, the experience I had yesterday with this whole announcement, whatever it was, by the president was, I don't know how to describe it, surreal. I think the last time I had an experience that was that bizarre was maybe reading Alice in Wonderland. I mean, there's just no connection whatsoever between this president and his comments and his characterization of the events and what is actually transpiring. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a defeat in Afghanistan. It's a disaster in Afghanistan. I don't know that we have words strong enough in the English language to describe the magnitude of what has just happened. We've been humiliated. We look powerless. We look impotent. All of our enemies are emboldened, but more immediately on the ground in Afghanistan, nothing has changed with Taliban in terms of their ideology. The only thing that's changed is that they are now much stronger, much better equipped. Their prestige has been enhanced dramatically. You know, this phrase, the terrorist superstate, I think is completely accurate. We are, prior to 9/11, they were providing safe haven to Al-Qaeda and a launching pad for attacks on the United States. And they are now much better equipped to do exactly the same thing. They have every intention of doing the same thing. They're going to support every evil organization on the planet. And in the White House, we have people saying things like Tony Blinken says that he believes they will respond to, you know, sternly worded diplomatic notes. And it's one of those, you don't know whether to laugh or cry moments. Like, good God, man, is it conceivable that you are so feckless that you believe that? Or are you actually just fully aware that you are lying to our faces? I hard to understand which it is.
In theory, it could be completely correct. They will respond, but they will respond with contempt and dismissiveness and redoubled effort. And that is presumably not what he has in mind, which speaks to your point about his fecklessness. But Sam, let me ask about this, because one of the things that I find particularly worrying about how this has played out is that it's, of course, not just the Taliban, or for that matter, the Sharia supremacists that will be gravitating to this new victorious regime and its terrorist superstate. It's also countries like China that have been both a victor, in a sense, as a result of our defeat, and have made no secret of their intention to collaborate with the Taliban and partner up with them to exploit their resources and otherwise build out their Belt and Road Initiative and so on. But specifically what I'd ask you, Sam, to address is the likelihood that the Chinese patronage of the Taliban will essentially foreclose the possibility that there will be any future efforts to either interfere with the business of that terror superstate or try to root out, once again, those operating against us from it.
Well, I think you put your finger on one of the really major factors here, and something that is a fundamental change from where we were, say, in 2001. The communist Chinese are much, much stronger and have made much more progress in their agenda to control the world. And they are, as you said, already lashed up with the Taliban. I know from sources on the ground in Afghanistan that there are already hundreds of Chinese personnel there from Chinese intelligence, and they're working with the Taliban, helping them with IT and communications and internet-related issues, all related to hunting down opponents of the new regime. So going through databases and helping them intercept cell phone calls and so forth. So that cooperation is already ongoing. Those ties obviously were established some time ago. That's just going to expand. So we may run into the issue moving against the Taliban of the fact that the Chinese have made them much more capable of resisting, providing them with capabilities they don't currently have. We may run into the issue of the Chinese overtly saying, basically, back off. If you touch Afghanistan, it's a problem with us. And then, of course, there's the entire other dimension here, which is we have a president and his entire cabinet who are at an absolute minimum incredibly sympathetic to the Chinese communist cause, if not overtly bought and paid for by them. So therefore, there's the dimension of how likely is it that, you know, China Joe is going to actually take an action that his sponsor, that his master, Xi Jinping, tells him not to. So there's a whole world there of complications that are going to make it much more difficult for us to do anything against the Taliban.
Yeah, that's such an important point. And Sam, I do want to salute you for work that you and Trevor Loudon have been doing to document the extent of such compromises of our senior leaders at accountabilityinitiative.org. It's a really terrific resource, as is, of course, Ant Magazine. But you're, you know, putting, you know, before the public the full extent to which China can reasonably expect to have its way with us, with our government, in whatever they decide to do. Is really alarming, and so it's so helpful to have that documentation available. But let me ask you about one other piece of this, Sam. You've spent during your time in the Central Intelligence Agency and this long war, endless war, as it's been called, in Afghanistan, considerable time in neighboring Pakistan. And I know you're very clear about the magnitude of the betrayal of Pakistan in the course of that war, despite our funding of the government, the army, the intelligence services of the country, it relentlessly worked to undermine our position and to help the Taliban ultimately achieve victory over us. Do you agree with a rising concern I'm hearing, and must say I share, that particularly with the kind of capabilities that the Taliban now have, military capabilities that they now have as a result of our bequest by Joe Biden of, by some estimates, $80+ billion worth of armaments. The Taliban may turn against their patrons and may seek to make part of their caliphate a Pakistan whose nuclear weapons would be liberated by them in the process. And to the extent you can comment about how China would view all of that, I think it'd be very, very helpful as well. But what are your thoughts about the Taliban and the possibility of it turning on its principal sponsors today?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very, very real possibility. I mean, the Pakistanis, as you said, have always worked against us and had very close cooperative relationships with the Taliban and helped them. You know, they've armed them, they've trained them, they've provided intelligence to them. So, but at the same time, the Pakistani government thinks it can sort of play both sides of, of the street here. They think they can walk this tightrope where they can support these groups in support of what they think are their interests. I mean, but somehow they can control them and keep them within limits. And it's always been it's not been ever a particularly well thought out philosophy. And lots of people have pointed out over the years that, you know, ultimately you're going to get burned by this same flame because the Pakistanis have a huge problem throughout their society and their military and their security services with folks that are militants, that are, you know, ideologically aligned with the Taliban and ISIS and Al-Qaeda and everybody else. So there's a very real possibility there that what you find is that you encourage this. And you thought you could keep the fire burning only across the border. And now you find that, you know, it's coming up through the floorboards in Islamabad. The Pakistanis have a large nuclear arsenal. And really worrying is the fact that as part of their doctrine to confront the Indians is that they have adopted essentially an early use policy. So because the Indians have overwhelming conventional superiority, the Pakistanis have made it very clear that they intend, if there's a major conventional war, to use nukes very early against the Indians. And to that end, they have pushed the nuclear weapons down to the operational, even tactical level. So they are not held in some central repository where they would be easier to control. They are dispersed around the country and they are directly under the control of commanders at relatively junior levels. So you now have that many more points at which, before we get to the Pakistani government doing anything, any one commander who decided that he was, that, you know, it was time for jihad could simply hand one of those weapons over to the Taliban. We've also seen in the past that Islamic extremists inside Pakistan are completely capable of launching large-scale attacks, even on supposedly secure Pakistani facilities. So, yeah, that's not science fiction. That's a very real possibility that you could wake up and find that the Taliban is now, you know, has set Pakistan ablaze.
And again, from your time in the tribal areas and elsewhere in Pakistan, your assessment of the individual commanders at a minimum, if not those higher up the military food chain, is that they could very well turn not only their own units and allegiances, but their arsenal, tactical nuclear weapons, perhaps included, over to the Taliban at a moment's notice. I mean, this is a stunning prospect. And you, from your time dealing with such people, I think have a special authority in saying that. And do you see any sign that the United States government at this point is more clear-eyed, first of all, about the nature of Pakistan and has any kind of contingency plan for dealing with such an eventuality? And again, Sam, if you would, tie in the Chinese to all of this. How do they fit into it, given their even closer relationship with Pakistan than what they've had with the Taliban?
Well, I mean, first, let me point out, just to sort of put the exclamation mark on this, none of this is theoretical. Back in the fall of 2001, When we were, of course, in Afghanistan already, overthrowing the Taliban at that point, there was another effort ongoing in Pakistan, and the Pakistani government ended up arresting a guy named Bashir Mahmood. And Bashir Mahmood was the former head of the Pakistani Atomic Energy Commission. He was the head of the Pakistani Atomic Energy Commission, and they arrested him because he was in contact with Osama bin Laden discussing building an atomic bomb for him. And he had already been fired from his job at the Pakistani Atomic Energy Commission because of his Islamic leanings, because he's so terrified the Pakistanis, they relieved him. But instead of quitting, he just then established contact with UBL and started talking about building him a bomb. So again, this is not science fiction. We've been down this road. Is this administration clear-eyed? Obviously not about anything. I mean, on top of whatever extent they've been co-opted and bought and paid for, they are completely feckless. I mean, they look into the camera and seriously talk to you about the fact that an organization that just defeated us in war after 20 years will be terrified when the United Nations passes a resolution about something. I mean, and you think, good God, man, can you possibly believe that? The Chinese are already on the ground in Afghanistan. They're going to exploit the mineral resources. They are going to provide the cash that the Taliban needs so that the Taliban will not care one whit about international sanctions of any kind. They're going to exploit this to the maximum potential to begin with, because I mean, it provides immense leverage against India and just in the entire region. So God knows how far this is going to go and how many Chinese you are going to see on the ground. So you are not going to see some little isolated terrorist state in Afghanistan. You are going to see a terrorist state with lots of money, with a lash up with the Chinese, with a lash up with the Pakistanis. My God, we're going to pay the price for this all over the globe.
Yeah, just very quickly, and putting a fine point on it, Sam, if the Chinese had to pick between the Pakistanis and the Taliban, how does that sort?
Well, I mean, they'll make a calculus at that point of who's of most value to them. But honestly, I don't see any reason why they can't take the Taliban and then overthrow the government of Pakistan and make them do what they want them to do.
There you go.
The Chinese have
coup de grace. Yeah, terrific. Sam, thank you for this really important conversation and your insights, as well as your great leadership, both in the past in your service to your country, but also that you're rendering these days. And again, folks, check out Sam's terrific book, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, as well as his great work at endmagazine.com. Come back to us again next week if you want to. Talking. Next up, we'll speak with former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs at Timberlake about the devil at our throat in China and more, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined by an old friend and valued colleague. His name is Edward Timberlake. He is one of our country's duty experts on China, among other things. He has served with great distinction in the uniform of the United States Marines, in which he was a fighter pilot. He has also been an assistant secretary in the Department of Veterans Affairs, instrumental in standing up that new cabinet office. He has also been a senior leader in the office of the Secretary of Defense, working in particular as the Director of Technology Assessment and International Technology Security. He is a very formidable American patriot, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Ed, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Frank, thank you so much for having me on in this very, very dark time at the national command of the American military establishment. It's pretty bad, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listener. So,
your voice, a lot of experience with national security and leadership in that arena is really appreciated and very much needed. So let me ask you to sort of key off of points that you made in an important piece at the American Thinker yesterday entitled, When the Devil Grabs You by the Throat. What was that about, and which is the devil to which you're referring at the moment?
Frank, I, as you did, we lived through some pretty horrific times. I had to reach back historically to the fall of Singapore first to show that when you surrender a fighting force, that is the beginning of the next chapter of horror. The British Commonwealth troops that were grabbed in the fall of Singapore, 80,000 surrendered to 30,000 Imperial Japanese troops. Well, 50,000 of them were brutally died, murdered, tortured. So I use that as a departure point into our war, my war, which was the end of Vietnam, the wall fell. And because of the way in which that war was cut off, Congress denied the funds, it became politically sensitive to discuss what was happening, not just in Vietnam, but more specifically Cambodia. And that's when the killing fields began. And about a third of that country was brutally massacred, butchered, because evil people took it over. So I saw devil, metaphorically, or you know, devout, perhaps the real devil, grabbing a nation, population, innocent population by the throat and killing them. So I projected forward to the fall of Afghanistan. And in doing so, the pattern and practice of ISIS and the Taliban and the rest of them are vicious. They are vicious people. I even pulled a punch. I mean, the stuff when I was in OSD that we watched them do, I couldn't even put in writing. It was so horrific. So the bottom line is we now have a situation in which the day after, where the administration spiked the ball in the greatest airlift since Berlin, blah, blah, blah. Well, that is not where you want to focus. You want the national and international press corps to continue, because they didn't in the killing spills for quite a few years, to continue to keep the microscope of accountability and transparency on what's going to happen in Afghanistan. As harsh as it may be in their minds to critique the Biden administration and the failed military leadership, they must do that because a lot of people are going to be butchered, massacred, killed, held hostage, extorted for money to get them out. Whatever horror story the listener can have in their mind, count on it. And that's what really caused me to write the article. It was the day after, which is today, of course. What really concerns me, Frank, and I saw this, I was on active duty when Saigon fell. I was recovering from bombing the Khmer Rouge, all people. I was in Chelsea Naval Hospital and then Weymouth. And we had the brother of the last Marine killed in our unit. So it brought it home quickly. But at that point, company grade officers, myself, I was a captain, we had tremendous confidence in the integrity, judgment, and leadership of the generals and admirals running the fleet and the Marine Corps. In fact, we had a Medal of Honor recipient, smiling Commandant Lou Wilson, known as the Smiling Cobra. He had Medal of Honor. So, but today, you're a company grade officer, and you watch over time the chairman, the secretary of defense, the president try and make a total fraudulent claim of their confidence and their desire to do what they did well. And it's hollow and it's frightening. And that's where the disconnect comes in. And that's what scares me more than anything, because our enemies are watching that. And the minute they pick up on that, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran and Israel kind of, I have a lot of faith in Israel, but China, Russia, North Korea, they watch this. They're taking the measure of President Biden, Vice President Harris, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and they're saying, to be very blunt, those pack of fools don't know when they're defeated. They don't know how to build a future military, and they're trying to apologize for it in taking a victory lap, which is the exact opposite of what they should do. There should be a full accounting. There should be some at least humble acceptance of what happened so they can learn and go forward. But PRing it is just the worst possible signal to the world that I can see right now. And they're doing it where the president is missing the time hacks. And I wrote a previous column on that. Look, the president of the United States can pick whenever he wants to talk to the American people. If he announces it hours ahead and he misses it by half hour, 45 minutes, and there's no news in what he's saying. Everything he said half hour late or 45 minutes late is what he could have said earlier. That tells me that the leadership of China and Russia see a national command authority that's fundamentally broken because they don't trust the President of the United States ready for prime time. They got to prep him, prep him, prep him. And that's another scary element to what's happened after the fall of
Ed, let me come back to how China particularly is responding to this, because you've written extensively about the Chinese and understand, I think, better than just about anybody what is operating in Beijing at the moment and its implications for us. But just staying with this theme of the military and the confidence, the, well, people in the ranks have in their leadership. Lieutenant Colonel Stu Scheller, United States Marine Corps, took the very bold and courageous step of actually publicly demanding accountability of those leaders. And as of now, he is the one person who has lost his job over this whole fiasco with Afghanistan. What does that tell you about sentiment within the ranks, as well as the likelihood there will be the kind of accountability that's so clearly required, as you said, and he did?
Well, that's a brilliant person to focus on. The courage it took for him to do that is tremendous. He stood up against everyone with integrity, moral courage, and intellectual judgment, and he's to be commended for that. What I found amazing, I read it this morning, apparently the Marines or the command structure sent him in for a psych eval. Now, remember, this was the man who commanded one of the most impressive combat grunt battalions in the Marine Corps. He prepped everybody to go forward. You don't get that command by being crazy or having PTSD. Lo and behold, he speaks out, and they take the Soviet approach, which is, oh my God, if he speaks out, there must be something wrong with him. Well, he'll survive that, and he'll become a veteran. And that's where it's going to go. There's two dimensions to this. One, the Chinese picked up on him, by the way, right away, and said he is the personification of the ranks crumbling and all that stuff. Well, they're full of crap on that. What he is a personification of the American fighting spirit that permeates the ranks. And below, the fools at the top, don't underestimate that. Don't underestimate fighting admirals with blue water under their feet right now, our Air Force generals ready on launch, fighter pilots or bomber pilots or transport pilots ready to go right now, or Army divisions standing ready. And the Marine Corps, of course, ever afloat, and they paid the terrible price. So China has misread the tone of the American military by saying the troops are crumbling. They're not crumbling. Good leadership, as we know, Frank, after Vietnam, the ones who stayed in and climbed up, they gave us Desert Storm. I mean, let's look at it realistically in terms of warfare. The ones who really stayed in and suffered the Carter hollow years, sucked it all up, and created a modern, competent fighting force in 100 hours that schwacked the fourth largest army in the world, which was Iraq at the time. Now, the bottom line is we have the leadership, which is sending the wrong signal, and China will play off that. Not only will they mock the ranks incorrectly, but they'll play off the indecision, the lies. I mean, they'll see it. And they are right.
And the lack of leadership and resolve at the presidential commander-in-chief level.
It's horrible.
Okay, so let's drill down on China then for a moment at Timberlake. And your assessment of the Chinese is, it sounds like, consistent with my own, which is there's a serious risk of miscalculation on their part at the moment. And I wanted just to ask you about something that I've written about in my commentary today, namely this pronouncement out of Beijing that henceforth any ships, whether they're warships or submarines or commercial vessels, transiting Chinese, quote, territorial waters, unquote, are going to be subject to a pre-registration and disclosure of their destinations and their routes and their contents. And if this were to be applied, as I assume is their intent, to the South China Sea, which the CCP is now calling part of their territorial waters, presumably this is going to become a flashpoint with respect almost certainly our own vessels, but those of the Taiwanese most immediately. Play this out for us against the backdrop of what you said, that there may well be serious risk of miscalculation on the part of the Chinese political and military leadership.
Absolutely, Frank. You put your finger right on an amazing flashpoint issue. Could you imagine the Chinese telling the skipper of a U.S. Attack submarine, oh, you have to surface and tell us how many torpedoes you have because you're going by Hainan Island, which is where that's their sub pen island. Oh, sure. Or an aircraft carrier going through the Straits of Taiwan. Oh, hey, skipper, would you mind pulling over and telling us how many F-35s or F-18s you have on your deck right now? We need to know what you're doing. The Chinese leadership are filled. I thought we were craven and stupid at times. They're just delusional. I mean, this is a marker they're putting down. One, it's unenforceable. But two, the arrogance of what they're trying to accomplish is amazing. But they did have a predicate for it that we kind of ignored and threw back in their face, because they announced ADIZ, Air Defense Identification Zones, and they scrambled aircraft to thwart it. And I talked to the vice chief of the Korean Air Force, a very courageous fighter pilot, and the Japanese, because the ADIZ covers their territory. I mean, they were flying there, and all of a sudden the Chinese says, wait a minute, we own it. Well, they're looking at them like they're idiots, and they fly through it. And what we learn, though, is the impotence or the operational characteristics of the Chinese scramble. So when they argue they're going to enforce something and then they fail, in their world, that's an issue of face. So by putting this out there, Frank, and making it a cause belli, which is, I think, where they're going with it, and I think you picked up on that. Well, there's going to be a couple of days where going on and on and on, where people ignore them, mock them, and don't yield to their arrogant lawfare. You know, they finally figure out the word lawfare. You know, let's make a treaty here and do it. I think, quite frankly, it's doomed to fail. I think it's incredibly stupid on their part, because the bounce back, or called blowback, will be horrendous when everybody ignores it. Now, if they want to pick a fight with a Taiwanese ship, well, they better hope. And this is where I get scared over Afghanistan, or fearful, that since we hung out other allies to dry and we destroyed NATO. Let's get frank here. The Europeans hold us in such disdain right now for the way in which we did this. So we have a lot of repairing to do on our part of alliance politics. And Taiwan comes – the Chinese went right to that a couple of days ago, by the way. So let's pray that even though the pack of fools got us in this dilemma, there are some people somewhere out there that recognize you got to stand tall, you got to have deterrence, and you got to push back forcefully without being provocative.
Play out this calculation on the part of the Chinese or miscalculation, as the case may be. I'm hearing, and I'd be very interested in your take on this, that Xi Jinping, despite everything he is trying to do to the contrary, to signal his total dominion inside China and his control, is actually facing some internal difficulties, economic, political, and otherwise. And as you know so well, Ed, one of the things that totalitarians not infrequently do in the face of such internal challenges is look externally, social engineering, it's been called, to justify repression at home and, you know, having everybody rally around the flag to go deal with some external threat, real or imagined. Is that likely under these circumstances? Is there at least a serious danger that what this may translate into is, in fact, Xi giving the People's Liberation Army its head and picking a fight, whether it's with the Taiwanese or maybe even with us directly, that could precipitate a hot war against this backdrop of our most recent defeat?
Yes, sir. I can't agree with you, as they say, squared. I mean, you nailed it. And here's the reason why. And that's why I'm such a hawk on following the presidential decision-making time. Because, quite frankly, once you escalate, and we both have nukes, in fact, it's pretty bad. In the Atlantic, we have a 3-to-1 nuke ratio of British, French, and us against Russia. In the Pacific, we're outnumbered 3-to-1, Russia, North Korea, and China, consequently, with nuke weapons in a strategic context. Consequently, as you say, if there's a flashpoint war that accelerates the potential, and remember, the Chinese, I'm not making this up, I'm not a throwback, you know, dinosaur on this one. At the height of an original Taiwan crisis, the Chinese said directly, are you willing to trade LA for Taipei? They said that. And that, when they say that, I believe it. When someone says they're going to kill you, believe them. So, Frank, not only...
Especially given the improvements they've made to their capacity to do that in the intervening years.
Yes, sir. They're building more silos, by the way, was just announced. They're going into a major strategic posture of launch and survival. They can, you know, they may be able to take a punch.
Nuclear war fighter.
Yes, sir. So we're going down a very slippery slope here, exacerbated by the Afghan debacle, because there are consequences to that. And as you say, the Chinese are watching, and I believe they probably put that edict out on assessing ships going through their water as a test. So it gives them the provocative statement. Okay, they'll pick the time and when they want to do it. You didn't do it, and they'll pick a fight. And if they pick a fight, it can escalate.
Yeah, and they go
to Taiwan, it escalates, and then it goes to strategic war. And our command structure at the highest levels, I'm not saying that the head of STRATCOM and NORTHCOM and all that aren't ready. They're fighting men in uniform and women in uniform. I have a lot of faith in them. It's the launch codes and the deliberation at the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, President, Vice President, that should give all Americans concern about the ominous threat of a real strategic war outbreaking. And that, I'm not a dinosaur on that.
We have to leave it at that, Ed, for the moment. Grim prospects, but important insights. And I so appreciate you sharing them with us. Come back to us again with updates on all of this
very soon, if you would. Thank you for your voice. It's powerful. Thank you, my friend. Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll continue our conversations along these lines with our next guest, Robert Charles, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to one of the people that we really value here at Secure Freedom Radio, and we've not talked with in a frightfully long time, and I regret that, and we'll try to remedy it going forward. His name is Robert Charles. He has served our country in the uniform of the United States Navy as a naval intelligence officer and in a variety of capacities, going back to the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, where he was a counsel in the White House. He has also most recently been an assistant secretary of state, responsible for the Bureau of Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, and has just a wealth of expertise that we value highly here and that he shares with and on behalf of the members of a terrific organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC. You can follow Bobby's writings there and other good works as its spokesman at amac.us. Robert Charles, it's good to have you with us. Mr. Secretary, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Frank. Tough times, and I'm glad to be back.
Tough times, and you're rendering a really important service, both for AMAC and I think for the country and the cause, with your effective descriptions and discussions in a variety of media outlets about what we are confronting. We've been talking in the course of this program with Sam Faddis and Ed Timperlake a bit about Afghanistan, what's happened there, what's likely to happen next, and I'd love to get your thoughts on that as well.
Well, let's just start here, Frank. I think that the most urgent understanding that people need to have is that we still have Americans in that country. And it is, to me, unforgivable that a president of the United States would have pulled our military out at a time when we have even one American still left in that country, never mind some tens of thousands of allies who helped us who are Afghan. So let me be concrete about what we know and what we don't. And I would encourage members of Congress and anybody else who has the capacity to seek these documents so that they can understand even more what we only have a peripheral understanding of now. Maybe 2 weeks ago, there was a document in the embassy there called the F-77. And the F-77 gives you a list of all of the Americans that are in the country. They never set up a registry, a crisis task force, which you typically do upon retreating from a country or from leaving a country. So there's another failing. But that F-77 form indicated that, and I've talked to people who saw it, that between 15,000 and 40,000 Americans were in Afghanistan. The reason there's a disparity is because they often add the family in, but then sometimes they don't. So the reality is that we had at least 15,000 in there. This administration says they pulled 5,500 out. That's what Secretary of State Blinken says. That leaves 9,500 Americans somewhere in that country, even if some of them are dual citizens. I know right now, they are trying to get out through Uzbekistan. I don't want to get into too much detail, but they're attempting to get out through Mazi Sharif. There are rat lines with ground transportation. There are innovations with air transportation. The State Department right now continues to hold up some clearances that would get people out to places like Ukraine. Bottom line is there is a panic afoot, and it includes both Americans and non-Americans. And this is not a story that you can just pivot away from and go away from. This is not, hey, I gave a speech, all's well, we're done. We're not done. And so, you know, I would go back. I did write about this a little bit recently, and I've written in several different venues. But, you know, we don't leave anyone behind. That's not in the American credo. We don't leave them behind when they're dead, and we certainly don't leave them behind when they're alive. And so this is a disgrace. And I'm going to say in the near term, that's what I'm most concerned about. In the midterm, that is to say, as soon as we get as many Americans out as we can possibly find and get them out, and allies who helped us, my next big thing would be, I think our national security team has really failed us. And that's the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the President and the Vice President. And I think we do not have a parliamentary system. We can't just do a vote of no confidence. So there are some resignations that need to happen. And I think they need to be demanded, you know, whether people come to Washington to demand them or whether our members of Congress demand them who are currently on recess. It's very, very problematic. And so that's the second big thing. And then the third thing is the implications of all this for the rest of the world. It is a statement of such weakness. It is a breach of faith with the American people. It is a breach of faith with our allies in Afghanistan. It is a breach of faith with our allies in Europe. It is a breach of faith with the past and all of those that lie in military cemeteries all over the world. It's a breach of faith. And I really think this is not something we're going to just be able to dust under the rug and say, on to the next thing. Gosh, what's the inflation rate? No, I don't think so.
Bobby, I want to come back to all of that in just a moment. But before we do, one other piece of what you've touched on here that you, I think, did not note is while relatively few Americans were extracted from Afghanistan, we had a huge number of Afghans. It seems over 100,000 of them. A considerable percentage of that, the number's a little unclear to me, but a considerable percentage of that have been brought right into this country. And there is reason to believe that at least some of them have not been vetted. I've seen numbers as high as 25,000 to establish that they are people that we have some reason to want to have in this country and confidence that they won't be a threat to us if they are here. You've spent a lot of time worrying about the threat posed by terrorists to our nation. You've warned about, you know, they're coming across our border. You've warned about their operations inside the United States. Talk a little bit about the possibility, if not the probability, that we will be confronting a heightened internal homeland security threat from those we have enabled to get here without appropriate, you know, rigor in terms of evaluating that decision.
So this is really, again, I'm going to say, Frank, facts are stubborn things, as Ronald Reagan, our former boss, used to say. This is a two-edged error. It again betrays a tremendous lack of planning, and really, which is to say, a combination of incompetence, amateurism, and really this breach of faith again. So of that 100,000 plus that came out, we know that there were 20,000 SIV visas that had been under review. The State Department unbelievably put just four people in consular affairs.
Those are special immigration visas for these Afghan friends who worked with us.
That's right. Those are immigration visas that were for people who worked with us for roughly 2 years during the 20-year period. And we had their lives were completely at stake. And by the way, those are just the ones that were able to apply. There were probably double or triple that number that worked for us that needed to get out, that whose lives were absolutely at risk. And those that are still in the country remain at risk. Unbelievably, I learned within the last 2 days that the State Department handed the list to the Taliban of all of the foreign service nationals that worked in the embassy for the last 20 years. I cannot imagine doing that. To me, that is another act of unconscionable behavior, you know, as well as giving up Bagram and all the rest. But it's a two-edged knife here. This is a two-edged failure. Not only did we not get out, from what I, again, am being told by people who know, Afghans who know and love America, who worked with us, who put their lives on the line on the promise that we would always look after them and get them out. So we broke faith with them. But then And this is, again, a fact. I talked to people who are very knowledgeable about the process at the airport, as well as the process where we're still trying to get, we're not, but others are, they're still trying to get out of the country. And we know that at the airport, they did not do vetting for a lot of the Afghans. What they did is they simply asked them questions and then they got them on the plane. Why? Because so many of them showed up with no documents. Now, when we were vetting, I was involved with others vetting the Iraqi police candidates, those that would become Iraqi police. One of the things you had to do is spend time with them if they didn't have documentation, because the only way you're going to get to hard facts is to look them in the eye and walk down through a series of questions that takes time. And then they have to be corroborated and you have to go back and do research. So the short of it is we didn't really do any vetting of these people at the airport. We had those that had documents. We had those that Americans knew, so they were on a list. But then there were those that just made a claim and showed up. And so the double-edged sword here or knife is that you get a group of people that are in the country that may or may not have good intentions. And until and unless you sit down eyeball to eyeball and vet them with what you know and cross-reference any links they have here in the United States, et cetera, you're really not going to know. And even then, there will probably be a fairly significant group that we're just going to have to watch and have trust that they don't do something that they shouldn't do. So, you know, I'm not saying, Frank, that there are any terrorists in that group. I'm just saying that this is yet another example of failed planning, a breach of faith, and we really don't know.
Yeah, this is the crux of the matter. Let me turn back to what we talked about a moment ago, and that is our adversaries who are emboldened by what they've seen here. We've talked with our colleagues prior to your visit, Bobby, about China. So let me ask you about a couple of the other countries that are probably also enormously heartened by this strategic defeat of the United States. And I want to sense out with you whether you agree there's a distinct possibility that they will be induced to act aggressively as a result. Let's start with a country that I know you've been following closely for a long time, going back to the Cold War era, of course, and that is Russia, the former Soviet Union, under Vladimir Putin. How do you think he is perceiving our leadership, our military might, our morale, our resolve? And do you think that's likely to conduce to aggressive behavior on his part, perhaps towards his neighbors, perhaps towards other vital interests we might have?
Yeah, I think there's no question, Frank, that I have had a few conversations with people, not as many as relate directly to Afghanistan, but about what the perceptions are. And I think Putin obviously feels he stumbled on a field of good fortune. He has an adversary that he has had it for his entire life that is now at the weakest point that it has ever been in his entire life. And so looking at the United States, I have no doubt that they will first do everything they can for case exploitation, pull things out of Afghanistan and maximize the value to themselves, as the Chinese will do. And they'll have access to them, so they'll be able to do that. They will also look in terms of concrete actions. I have no doubt this will hearten the internal thinking of his leadership about whether or not they go into some piece of Eastern Europe. I think Ukraine is the most obvious potential risk, but I think there are other pieces, the Baltics and other parts of the world even. I think they will look and evaluate in a strategic way where our weakness allows them. It's not even a gamble. It's a reality. We ran away, left our own citizens, left tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars worth of equipment. I saw pictures yesterday morning of the helicopters that the INL Air Wing runs. That's a State Department air wing. Those were air assets that I had authority over. They've all been given now. So the Russians are going to look at this and they're going to say strategically, the same way, put your red cap hat on. I mean, red team this. They're going to look at it and say, okay, where are the weak spots in the world that we can move? Do we elevate pressure in Syria? Do we take different pieces of the Middle East? Do we now put pressure on other parts of the Far East, India? Do we look at what we can grab in this hemisphere? Do we move now to hearten or reinforce efforts in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Peru? The answer is they will do They're not stupid. They will do exactly what we would do. They see weakness here that is profound, probably unprecedented in the last 100 years, and they're going to say, what do we do with it?
How to capitalize on it. Bobby, I'm so glad that you mentioned Latin America, because we've talked with you about this from time to time in recent months. Peru is a country that we both know and have affection for, and it is in the process of going down the communist, tubes. When you look at the opportunities for a Russia or a China, to say nothing of Cuba or even Iran, in a place like Peru, what are the consequences that's likely to translate into for us here in the United States? Why should it be of concern to us that Russia might feel emboldened, or China or the others, to redouble their efforts to capitalize on a communist coming to power in Lima and all that might open up to them?
Yeah, so let me start with the outer concentric circle and work in. Look, Frank, the United States of America must have a presence around the world in every hemisphere, speaking to the very rights that we see embodied in our Bill of Rights, or there will be no voice for those rights. We must, and then when push comes to shove, whether it's on economic development, whether it's in institution support, whether it's support for them internally when their populations turn in the direction of wanting those rights or wanting to preserve those rights or having lived with those rights and not wanting them taken away, we have to be the beacon. We must be the voice. We have to be the voice that Ronald Reagan and Theodore Roosevelt and everybody that was in our founding fathers all believed, without entanglements as much as possible, but as much as possible, understanding that this idea of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that Jefferson helped write for the French, the idea of our Bill of Rights, this is real stuff. And it's a hard and fast element of natural law. If we don't defend it, no one will. So on the flip side of that, when a country like Russia, which is autocratic, or Iran, which is theocratic, or China, which is pure communist, straight up, when they see opportunities, it's the old adage that you pull your fist out of the bucket and the water fills in pretty fast around where you were. They are going to go straight into a place like Peru. They're going to try to bribe. They're going to try to coerce. They're going to try to gain access to the port. They're going to try to do everything they can to put a footprint, a communist footprint, down deep as they can get it into the soil in that country. The people will resist in Peru because the people of Peru understand freedom. But look at Venezuela. Look at what Cuba, Cuba once was a free country. We're in a position now where we need to understand. We need to start. Here's the bottom line, Frank. We need to sober up. OK, this is a serious moment in a serious world. And this leadership in the United States is looking at this like it's some sort of a board game. This is not a board game. This has real consequences, and it will have consequences for us.
Amen. Bobby, we have to leave it on that sobering note. It is one that I know we will come back to you to discuss further, and most especially to address what we do in this moment. But thank you for your time today. Thank you for your service to our country, which continues, among other places, at the Association of Mature American Citizens. I know you'll keep up the good work, and we'll look forward to our further visits. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.